Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio231. It is Wednesday, the 12th of September. So does anybody have any questions about anything? I don't see any questions. That's wonderful. I did get the lectures online for you to download and listen to. I think I sent an email out to everybody. If you did not get the email, then you're in violation of the syllabus, right? Because you have to have an email account that I can communicate with you with. So make sure that you have a good email address in Blackboard so that I can send you stuff periodically, like that announcement regarding the lectures. All right, so the schedule we see right here, today's the 12th. We're going to start talking about the integumentary system, integument. Then next time, we're going to talk about the beginning chapter, orientation chapter on bones and skeletal tissue, but there are no bones necessarily in this chapter. Then you have our first exam, 1 week from today. And then after that exam, then we're going to start with the axial skeleton, which is the skull and vertebral column and rib cage and things like that. So I think we're doing pretty good as far as the schedule goes. Just one point in Blackboard, since we had to rearrange the schedule, since this is a short semester, the study guide for chapter six is included in or under exam number two, not exam number one. So don't forget, chapter six is on exam number one, and that study guide in Blackboard is under exam number two. All right, so it just kind of wraps in there, so you have to go find that. All right, so the integumentary system. Let's see, any other announcements? How's SI going? Anybody go to SI? Yeah, good. All right, what else? That's about it. Oh, let's see. After that first exam, then is the first lab practicum. Okay, so that's still about 2 weeks away, a little bit more than 2 weeks. Week and, no, week and a half away, week and a half away, that first lab practicum. All right, so the integumentary system is composed of skin plus some accessory structures. Let's look at this figure right here. And accessory structures would be hair, for instance, or nails, or glands. And I see a couple different kinds of glands. A sebaceous gland right here is always going to be associated with a hair follicle 100% of the time. And then here's a sweat gland. This is an eccrine sweat gland that you have over most of the parts of your body, and its job is to secrete a watery and salty solution onto the surface of your skin for the purpose of cooling your body down when you get hot, right? Because that water evaporates, and that heat of evaporation cools your body down. All right, so there is, on my website, okay, dr-j-gober, an integument tutorial that is a video that you can download, and it is captioned, which goes over a figure that's very similar to this one right here. All right, so there's another lecture online. It's for a Bio-160 class, but it's a very similar kind of diagram. Not quite the same detail that we're going to go over, but very, very similar. Oh, what else could you see here? Skull bones flash quiz. So people that are interested in learning skull bones, which we start this week in lab, here's another nice video for you to look at. Yeah. Okay, those are going to be in Blackboard, and if we have time after lecture, I'll show you. It's going to be under the Documents button. It's in the left-hand frame, so click on Course Documents, and then scroll down, and histology slides and mitosis slides and skin slides will be there for you to see. It's kind of where I keep all the videos, under Documents. So I kind of consider a video a document. All right, so here is some skin. It's the largest organ system in your body, and it functions to protect internal structures like muscles and nervous system and bones from infections, but also, just as important, maybe even more important, from dehydration, right? Because we're a solution. A lot of chemistry takes place, or biochemistry takes place in a watery solution, and that's what we are. And if we didn't have skin, then we would dehydrate very quickly, just within a matter of minutes, and that biochemistry would stop, and of course, then the life processes would stop. But there are some other functions besides protecting you from infection and protecting you from dehydration. It helps regulate body temperature. Can you think of a gland that's associated with helping you regulate body temperature? For instance, if you get too hot, what gland becomes activated? Yeah, this eccrine sweat gland right here becomes activated, right? Sweat is deposited on the surface of your skin that cools you down. The skin is also important for producing a form of vitamin D. And vitamin D is necessary. Anybody know what vitamin D is necessary for? A number of different things. We're learning more and more functions all the time. But one classical understanding of vitamin D is that it's necessary for calcium absorption from your diet. So, and of course, you know calcium is important for bones, but if you have calcium in your diet but no vitamin D, that doesn't really help you out. Okay, so skin is important for producing vitamin D, but skin has to be exposed to sunlight in order for that to happen. And also for sensation. Integument is important for sensation. It helps you communicate with your environment. Like what kind of sensations do you recall on your skin? Hot, cold, maybe burning sensation. But what else? Yeah, pain. And so we talked about temperature. Also, hair follicles. You can feel a breeze on your skin, for instance. Okay, so these are sensory organs in a certain sense. These hair follicles right here. All right, so all those functions are very important. All right, so let's look at the anatomy of the skin. And in this class, we spent a lot of time looking at layers of various organs, and it might seem like a lot of busy work, but understanding layers is very important in anatomy and in medicine as well. Not just because that they are there, but because they have special functions, and when your body starts to misbehave, it's due to some disruption of these layers right here, and understanding which layer is disrupted and to what degree, then it's possible to come up with a good diagnosis of what's happening to a patient. And if you have a good diagnosis, then you can, if you have a good diagnosis, what can you do? Hopefully, not in all cases, but yeah, then you can come up with a treatment, but you can't even come up with a treatment for disease if it can't be diagnosed. And then if you know what kind of treatment is available, then you also know what the prognosis is. So by knowing layers, we know a lot about how we can stage a disease, what kind of disease it is, what treatments are possible, and then what the possible outcomes are as well. So layers are very important. It's not just because they're there. All right, so the skin has got two main layers. The first layer is relatively thin. It's what we call the epidermis. And there are sublayers within the epidermis that we're going to look at, but here is the epidermis. And the epidermis is an epithelium. One characteristic of epithelium is that it does not contain blood vessels. But it might contain some nerve fibers. Okay, and probably some of you have gotten a paper cut or some kind of cut on your skin and you go, oh, wow, that hurt really bad. And you kind of held it closed, but you're afraid to look because you don't want to see all this blood gushing out of your finger, for instance. And then you look, and there's no blood at all there to see. And that's because there are no blood vessels in the epithelium. So if it's a nice superficial cut, maybe you cut a nerve fiber, but no blood vessels, so it's not even going to bleed. And you get no sympathy from anybody either when that happens. Okay, so that is the epidermis. It's an epithelium. And how do we classify an epithelium? There's two ways that we classify an epithelium. What are the two ways? The shape of the cells and the number of layers from the basement membrane up to the apical surface. And if we look at this, maybe it's not really zoomed in, and I don't want to lose my cursor right here, but can you tell that there are many layers of cells that make up the epidermis? Okay, so this is a stratified squamous epithelium because the cells in the superficial layer near the apical surface are flat cells. A stratified squamous epithelium is designed to be in parts of your body that experience abrasion or rough treatment so that these cells on the apical surface break away, but they're replaced by the deeper layers of cells that are undergoing mitosis and proliferating in the deepest layers of the epidermis. All right, so we're going to talk more about the epidermis in a little bit. Then the deep layer from here all the way down to here, this is what we call the dermis. Now, how much is missing from your slide? Same as mine here. That's okay. I can slide it over a little bit. There. All right, so the next deepest major layer is the dermis. And hence, now you know why this first layer, the first superficial layer, is called the epidermis. Epi means on top of the dermis is what that means, or superficial to the dermis. So here is the dermis. It has two main layers. We can talk about these right now. These projections of the dermis into the epidermis right here, these are what we call dermal papillae. These projections, and there are blood vessels that project up into these papillae that bring nutrients to the epidermis, because remember, the epidermis doesn't have its own vascular supply. So this layer right here, next to all of these dermal papillae, is called the papillary layer. Papillary layer is loose areolar connective tissue. So it has some collagen, it has some elastic fibers, it just doesn't have a whole lot of collagen, right? It's a pretty loose tissue. The next deepest layer of the dermis is called the reticular layer. So here's the reticular layer, not shown on this slide, but we got some micrographs later in the chapter. You're going to see a lot of collagen fibers in the reticular layer of the dermis. So this layer is misnamed a little bit. We should probably call this the collagenous layer of the dermis, but it's called reticular. What can you tell me about reticular fibers? They're really, really weak. And that's not a characteristic of the reticular layer right here. Because it has collagen, it's a very strong layer, and this is the layer that leather products come from. So when you're wearing shoes or leather jacket, this is the part of the hide of that animal that produced that product for you. Not the epidermis, not the papillary layer. Okay, and as a matter of fact, if you lacerate your skin and put a big hole in your skin right here, there's so much collagen in the reticular layer of the dermis, it's easy to put a suture in to approximate those two ends of the wound together, pull them together, and that suture just stays nice and fixed. It doesn't rip out. But it would rip out if it was just epidermis or areolar connective tissue. So that collagen is very helpful. It's very, very strong. And where do we have that collagen? Where do we find collagen in the reticular layer of the dermis? Where are you going to find collagen? What kind of tissue? It's connective tissue. Yeah, what are the main areas of a connective tissue? Yeah, the matrix. You got the matrix, which is the extracellular material, and then you've got the cells. Intracellular material. So in a connective tissue, you got intracellular material and the matrix. That collagen is in which one of those two? It's in the matrix. Yeah, it's being secreted by fibroblasts into the matrix. Collagen is not intracellular, it is extracellular. It's a chemical that is extracellular that gives the dermis its strength. All right, so two main layers, epidermis and dermis right here. We see some other structures. These are accessory structures. We see a hair follicle. And here's the shaft of the hair follicle protruding above the layer of the skin. And there's a muscle that attaches to the epidermis, and it goes down to a hair follicle over here that's called an arrector pili muscle. It's a smooth muscle. You can't control it, but it is controlled automatically in your body when you're cold or scared. It contracts, and it pulls this hair follicle vertical and also pokes it up out of your skin, so that forms a goosebump or a goose pimple right here. Somebody should do a Google and find out what the real scientific name for a goosebump is and if there's any pathologies associated with that. I'm not familiar with that. I would like to know something about that. All right, so arrector pili. Other accessory structures that we see always associated with a hair follicle, so here's a hair follicle, is a gland that secretes an oily substance onto the shaft of the hair as it's growing out so it can grow out very easily. This is a sebaceous gland. So here's a sebaceous gland. Here is that eccrine sweat gland that we were talking about. And there's another gland that you'll see in a model in lab that's called an apocrine gland. An apocrine gland secretes not a water and salty solution like an eccrine sweat gland, but an organic solution. We find these in the inguinal region and axillary region, so that's your armpit and groin area. And since it's an organic kind of fluid, then it can be used as an energy source for bacteria. So bacteria have an easier time growing and proliferating in those areas of your body, and so those areas of your body are slightly more odoriferous compared to other parts that don't have apocrine glands. All right, so that will help you remember where these apocrine glands are a little bit. Okay, the next deepest layer, it's not part of the integumentary system. It's this adipose tissue right here that's a subcutaneous layer. And sometimes we call it the hypodermis. Hypo means below, epi means on top of the dermis. Hypodermis is just this layer below the dermis. And it's there because it stores energy in the form of fat, but it also helps attach your integument to underlying structures like bones and nerves and muscles and things like that. So it really is a nice connective tissue. Okay. And in that subcutaneous layer, a person may store up to about half of their personal fat just in that layer. All right, so let's look at the epidermis in particular. We said that it's what, a stratified squamous epithelium, so it's made up of a lot of layers. It's a permeability barrier, and it also protects against abrasion. That layer can rub off, but those cells are being replaced. The deepest layer, right above the basement membrane, is called the stratum basale, and that's the living layer of cells. They're undergoing mitosis. When a cell is undergoing mitosis, we call that proliferation because you get more cells, right? That's a growth process. And then they start to migrate up to the surface, and the most superficial layer is what we call the stratum corneum. These cells are dead, and they're filled with a chemical that makes them relatively hard, which protects your skin. That chemical is what we call keratin. So these cells on the superficial layer right here, sometimes we call these keratinocytes because they're producing keratin. What's another chemical that gives your body strength besides keratin? And we just got done talking about it. Collagen. Okay, but what's a big difference between keratin and collagen? Where do you find collagen again? In the matrix, it's outside the cells, but keratin is inside the cells. It's not in the matrix, right, because an epithelium does not have a matrix. It's inside the cell. So make sure you can spell the difference and understand the difference between keratin and collagen. Collagen's in a connective tissue. Keratin is going to be in an epithelium, either within a layer, or it's a chemical that we find in hair. And hair is tougher than skin, so it has more keratin in it compared to the keratinocytes that make up the layers of the skin. And there's another accessory structure on your skin that has even more keratin than hair. Can anybody think of what accessory structure that could be? What do you have? What part of your integument is even harder than hair? Yeah, your nails have more keratin. These are keratinocytes that make up nails, but they're really loaded with a lot of keratin, more so than your skin and hair. So your nails are a little bit stronger, but they're basically made out of the same kinds of cells right here. All right, and the cells move from the stratum basale up to the stratum corneum. They turn in from a columnar or a cuboidal cell to a flat cell or squamous cell. All right, so that's what I want you to know about that. Sometimes if there's an area of abrasion on the skin that is repeated over and over again, it can form a callus. So there's just going to be a thickening of the stratum corneum in that layer. And if that is a constant irritation, then that can form a corn over some bony prominences that are right underneath the skin. Right, and those can be real painful. It can be an inflammation, but it's just the stratum corneum gets very, very thick and very, very hard in that area. It just builds up a lot of cells that are filled with keratin to try to deal with that abrasion. All right, so let's look at some layers of the epidermis. Let's see what we have for some layers. What's a really good slide for layers? I guess this right here is a good illustration. We see an illustration here of the skin. This is similar to an exam figure. I like the figure that was in the previous edition of the book compared to this one. But here is the basement membrane, and above it is the epidermis. So here's the apical surface of the epidermis. Here's the basal surface of the epidermis, right? Because that's how we talk about an epithelium. So the first layer is the stratum basale right here near the basal surface. These cells are undergoing mitosis, and if I look closely, I might be able to see a cell in anaphase or prophase. I guess I don't see one immediately, but that is the stratum basale. It's one or two cell layers thick, and that's about it. And these are the living cells. And when mitosis takes place and one of the cells migrates up, okay, toward the surface, a little bit more superficially, and then the cells start to get glued together by these things we call desmosomes, and it distorts the shape of the cell, kind of gives it a little spiky appearance in certain places, and or a spiny appearance, and so we call this the stratum spinosum. But this is the layer where the cells start to get glued together to form your integument. And then they get pushed up a little bit closer to the surface. And now these cells right here, they still have their desmosomes, but now I see some granules inside the cytoplasm. These granules are filled with a chemical, a pre-keratin chemical, and keratin is going to eventually give these cells a lot of strength, as well as some granules that contain lipids. And those lipids then can be secreted outside the cell, and it works as waterproofing. That's what produces the the dehydration barrier on your skin. So the stratum granulosum, right, produces some chemicals, keratin, which makes these cells tough, but also some lipid molecules that prevent you from dehydrating. All right, then from the granulosum, they move up into the corneum. This layer is filled with dead cells, right, and now they're no longer undergoing or have any kind of biochemistry. They're filled up with all the keratin that they're ever going to have, and the waterproofing has been secreted on the outside, and it's the thickest layer in the epidermis. So the layers are basale, spinosum, granulosum, and then corneum, with stratum, of course, being the first word in all of those. So this is a really good example of what we call thin skin. The stratum corneum is sort of thick, but not very thick compared to thick skin. So let me show you a micrograph of thick skin. Here is thick skin. So, and again, skin has the dermis as well as the epidermis right here, and we can see all those layers within the epidermis that we were just talking about. The stratum basale right here, then the next superficial layer, these are the spiky cells. This is the stratum spinosum, and then we see some cells that have granules in them. This is the stratum granulosum. And on this particular kind of skin, I see another layer that's very clear. That's what we call the stratum lucidum. It's very transparent. That kind of layer is found only in thick skin. So the previous slide would be an example of thin skin because I don't see the stratum lucidum in this layer right here. But I see it right here, that white line, that's the stratum lucidum, so I know this is thick skin. And then if we were to compare thickness to thickness, look at the stratum corneum, the most superficial layer. That's really thick when we look at thick skin. All right, so you might be wondering about yourself, where do I have thick skin? Where do I have thin skin? You have thin skin mostly all over your body. Any place on your skin where you have a hair follicle, that's thin skin. Okay, but on the palms of your hands, soles of your feet, you have that additional layer, the stratum lucidum, and this very thick layer of stratum corneum. And you also have these exaggerated dermal papillae in thick skin as well. And these come together to form a ridge on the surface of the skin that we call, you're familiar with already, these things are what we call fingerprints, right? So these dermal papillae, right, get pushed up to the surface of the skin and they help form fingerprints. So here is a good example of thick skin because it has that additional layer. Here is an illustration of thin skin, and here's a micrograph of thin skin. Here's the basement membrane, so here's the dermis, this first layer of cells. Oh, look, here's one that looks like it's undergoing mitosis right here. All right, this is the stratum, go ahead, say it out loud. This is the stratum basale, yeah, because I don't want you to fall asleep. Then the next superficial layer is the stratum spinosum, and then here's that granulated layer called the stratum granulosum, and then all these cells are made up of dead keratinocytes filled with keratin. This is the stratum corneum. So this is thin skin, and comparing that with thick skin has that additional layer called the stratum lucidum. All right, so I don't think I missed anything on the word slide over here. What is extracellular glycolipid good for? It acts as what? A permeability barrier. It keeps you from dehydrating, right? So it's like an oily substance between the cells that prevents dehydration. That's very important. All right, is keratin, there it is keratin intracellular or extracellular? It's intracellular. What strong chemical compound is extracellular? That would be collagen, right? Okay, and a stratified squamous epithelium like the epidermis right here is specialized for what kind of purpose in your body? It's designed to be in an area that experiences a lot of abrasion or roughing up. All right, so your clothes are rubbing on your body all the time, that would wear your skin out, but because this is a stratified squamous epithelium, these cells in the basale are always replacing those that slough off up at the surface. Okay. Oh, the stratum basale goes by another name. I'm glad I looked at the word slide. Sometimes it's called germinativum or germinating layer because when you take a seed, like a pea seed or a bean seed or a corn seed or a flower seed, and put it in the ground and water it, it turns from a seed to a growing plant. There's actually a little embryo that's in suspended hibernation inside the seed, and it comes to life when you water it. When that suspended embryo turns into a living plant that's growing, we say that seed has germinated because it's starting to grow. So germinativum is what? The growing layer in the epidermis, otherwise known as the stratum basale. Okay, the dermis we can see very nicely on this slide right here. The papillary layer right here is areolar connective tissue. It has some elastic fibers, so your skin can stretch, and as long as you don't overstretch it, what happens to it? It goes back to where it was, right? You can stretch, your muscles can bulge, right? And then when you relax that muscle, the skin goes back to where it was. But that can be damaged, like for instance during pregnancy, when a woman's skin over her stomach becomes very, very large, that damages the elastic fibers as well as the collagen fibers in the dermis, and that produces a little scar that we call striae, or what? Stretch marks. Yeah. Okay. So the strength in the dermis comes from collagen and elastic fibers, very few reticular fibers. In the papillary region right here, the collagen is oriented in all different directions, but in the reticular layer, you can see collagen, right, kind of oriented in one direction. So the reticular layer, since it has more collagen, is the strongest layer of the skin. Okay, so it's made up of dense, irregular connective tissue. Strength is due to collagen and elastic fibers and not reticular fibers. All right, so that's pretty good. Do you see the collagen fibers in this micrograph right here? I think you should be able to see them. All right, let me go back a couple slides, like this one right here. All right, so we saw some keratinocytes, but we see some other kinds of cells in this illustration. We see a tactile cell embedded in the stratum basale. And this tactile cell is important for vibration and for very fine touch. And sometimes this is called a Merkel's disc. Merkel's disc. I think that's in your chapter someplace. All right, here's another cell that has a lot of projections going between cells within the stratum spinosum, and it can be down in the basale, it could be up in the granulosum as well. It's called a dendritic cell. And this dendritic cell, because it's crawling around, is looking for bacteria and other kinds of infectious agents, maybe like a fungus or other kinds of infectious material. And when it bumps into it, it will try and destroy it. So this is an immune cell. A dendritic cell is an immune cell. Sometimes it's called a Langerhans cell. Langerhans or dendritic cell. Then we got another kind of cell right here. It's called a melanocyte. And a melanocyte's job is really important. It produces a compound called melanin, and melanin is a pigment. So now you know names of a number of different kinds of chemicals. You know keratin, collagen, here's another one, melanin. And melanin is a pigment. Pigments, people put pigments into things to give them color. So if you want paint to look yellow, you need to put a yellow pigment in the paint to make it look yellow. Like in these chairs right here kind of look yellow to me. They have a yellow pigment. So the chairs, right, when you shine white light on them, white light is made up of all the different colors of the rainbow. Right, so if you shine a white light through a prism or a drop of water, it's going to break into all kinds of different colors, like what, red, orange, green, indigo, violet, blue. Right, so those are all different energies, all different wavelengths of light. A pigment is a chemical compound that will absorb some of those colors, but not everything. So these chairs right here, since they're yellow, they absorb blue. They absorb green, right, and red, but the yellow wavelength of light hits that chair and bounces off into your eye, and so it looks like yellow. Okay. The pigment in people, right here, melanin, right, is more of a brown color to it, so it can absorb especially ultraviolet light and blue light, which is a damaging wavelength that comes from the sun. So a melanocyte is a cell that produces a natural sunscreen that we call melanin, and it protects your skin from sunburn. So the darker your skin is, It means the more melanocytes you have, and the melanocytes are more active compared to somebody that has lighter skin. And the advantage is then that you are protected from the damaging energy coming from the sun. So the darker your skin is, then the more protected you are from sunlight. And guess what the most damaging thing you can do to your skin is? It's just go out in sunlight, right? So sunlight produces a lot of damage to the epidermis as well as the dermis. It damages collagen fibers. It damages elastic fibers. It has a tendency to kill fibroblasts that are in the dermis. All right, so the darker your skin is, the younger your skin will look over your lifetime. All right, so somebody with really dark skin will have really healthy, young-looking skin for a longer period of their life than somebody that has very fair-colored skin, because fair-colored skin is so damaged by sunlight. Especially in the southern part of the United States, probably not so bad if you live in Seattle, right? But if you live anywhere in the world where the sunlight is very, very strong, then you probably shouldn't even go out in it without wearing a hat or sunscreen, okay? All right, so that's the job of these melanocytes right here. So I think this is an exam figure, so make sure you know the names of all of these different cells as well as the layers. All right. Let's talk about skin color for a little bit. We just got done talking about pigments, okay? What's the name of a pigment in skin? Melanin. It's brown to black in color. It's a chemical that absorbs light, and then it protects your skin from that energy source. But you also have blood that's in the dermis, so that can be pretty close to the surface of your skin. And, of course, blood is red when it's oxygenated, so it will give some people, if they don't have a lot of melanocytes, kind of a pink color. And, of course, on your lips, where you don't have a lot of melanocytes, people's lips look kind of pink because there's a superficial blood supply in lips, and even, like, ears might be kind of pink if you're a rabbit because of the blood that's flowing through them. All right, so that contributes to skin color. All right, the natural sunscreen is called melanin. Melanocytes produce melanin, and it's an intracellular pigment, and these melanocytes live in the stratum basale. Which layer is the stratum basale? It's the deepest layer in the epidermis. Moles and age spots are an increased number of melanocytes. So these melanocytes might proliferate over your lifetime, and if there's a group of them here, then that produces a little bit of a darker color on the surface of your skin, just in that one little localized area. All right, freckles are increased melanin production. So it's the same number of cells, but these cells become a little bit more active, and they produce more melanin granules, and so that area also will become a little bit darker in people. Usually that's not age-related compared to moles or age spots. Okay, and then every once in a while, somebody's born, and they have lost the ability to convert a form of melanin, which is clear, into the dark form of melanin. They are missing an enzyme that produces the dark form of melanin, so their skin looks completely white as a result of that, right? And their hair is white as a result of that, because the melanin gets incorporated into our hair, okay? And that condition is called albinism. It's the inability to produce the dark form of melanin. It's inherited and congenital, so it's not developmental. It's not something that develops over a person's lifetime, okay? So would a person with albinism, would they like to live in Ecuador? Ecuador is right on the equator. That's where the sun is the strongest, right? So their skin would burn just by being out in the sun, probably just seconds, 30 seconds, maybe a minute at the most, right? So I don't see very many people with albinism even in Southern California because the sun is so damaging to them. But this is not on your list right here, but I have bumped into people that have spots on their body that are white, that kind of mimics this condition of albinism. And I mentioned it, and I forgot what it's called. Vitiligo, thank you so much. Okay, vitiligo is a condition where these melanocytes become damaged, or the melanin becomes damaged in these people, and we think it's an autoimmune disease where a person's own immune system thinks that this melanocyte or the melanin is a bacteria or a foreign substance, attacks it, and then kills it in some small part of the body. Sometimes it's progressive, sometimes it's localized to one region. And one of my nephews has, what is it called again? Vitiligo on his forehead. Okay? And so anytime he goes out surfing, he's got this bright white spot right here. What does he have to be really concerned about? That he doesn't, that he puts a lot of sunscreen right on that spot because there's no protection from ultraviolet light right there. Okay, and that is more of a developmental condition rather than a congenital or inherited condition. Might be partially inherited, but it's not congenital. Cyanosis is a condition where a person's skin will look kind of blue, and that's because of blood vessels. Blood vessels, all right, will have a red color blood going through them when the blood is oxygenated. So oxygenated blood looks red, but when blood gives up oxygen to the tissues, right, it turns from a red color to a bluish color. And so if somebody has problems with their heart or problems with their lungs and blood is not being oxygenated properly, then they'll have a bluish cast to them, and we call that cyanosis. All right, so if somebody is cyanotic, right, that's a nice indication of some kind of cardiovascular disease or pulmonary disease. And when somebody's born, right, they're diagnosed as soon as they're born. Their reflexes are monitored, and their respiratory rate is monitored. Their skin color is looked at right away, and it goes into a score. Anybody know what that score is called when they measure reflexes as soon as you're born? It's called an Apgar score, okay? And if you have a yellow cast to you, and I'm sorry, a blue cast to you, then your Apgar score is lower. That means you're not as viable an infant, and people become very concerned. And it might be that you have a heart defect, for instance. And then some imaging studies of the mediastinum then are indicated to find out about the structure of the heart or great blood vessels coming off the base of the heart. All right, so cyanosis is a condition where your blood is not being oxygenated properly. Jaundice is another abnormal condition, but instead of looking kind of blue, all right, the skin is going to look yellow, and it could be a very bright yellow. And even if somebody has a lot of melanocytes and their skin is pretty dark, you can still see jaundice underneath fingernails because there's not a lot of melanocytes, or even in the whites of a person's eyes, all right, if they're jaundice. And jaundice could be due to a couple of different reasons. And again, it's looked at right away as soon as somebody's born. And it could be due to a breakdown of somebody's blood. Maybe there's an immune mismatch between the mom and the fetus in utero. So the mom's antibodies start to destroy the red blood cells of the fetus. Anybody know what that's called? It's called hemolytic disease of the newborn, or erythroblastosis fetalis. And so if the blood types of the mom and dad don't match up just exactly right, an infant could be born jaundiced. And that chemical, that yellow pigment, is pretty toxic to a nervous system of a newborn baby. Not so toxic to adults, but to a newborn baby, it sure is. All right, so that should be treated. But when red blood cells die and are broken down, they're processed by the liver. So jaundice could be due to breakdown of red blood cells or liver damage as well. And that's usually how it shows up in adults when there's liver damage. Could be due to chemotherapy or alcohol abuse or viral infection. It could be just due to a hepatitis. Okay, so a yellow cast, a marked yellow cast would be jaundice. A blue cast to somebody is cyanosis. All right, and then we have birthmarks in the dermis. And birthmarks, we all have spots all over our body. And that's due to an increased area of blood vessels in some region of your body. So it's probably going to look a little darker pink, okay, or red more than anything else. Okay, so why do we want to look at some of these different layers of the skin? Okay, let's refresh some of our memory on layers. The first main layer is the epidermis, and then the deepest layer here is the dermis. Okay, and remember the epidermis has the stratum basale, and what layer is that? What can you tell me about the basale? Is it living or dead? It's living, right, because it's close to these blood vessels. All right, so when your skin gets damaged, it's the stratum basale that rejuvenates your skin, that provides cells to these cells that are damaged. All right, so here is the stratum basale, and then I see a nice hair follicle right here. All right, so we're really interested in layers. Let's pretend that this person right here has a burn. All right, so the heat is coming from outside their body, and there's different kinds of burns. There's a first degree, second degree, and third degree burn. A first degree burn is the where you have some damage to some superficial layers of the skin, like the stratum corneum right here. And some of that heat maybe goes down into the dermis and it causes these blood vessels in the dermal papillae to become a little leaky or dilated, so that area is going to look a little red in color. All right, but that's kind of a lucky person that only gets a first degree burn, because that only burns the stratum corneum. And what can you tell me about the cells in the stratum corneum? They're dead already, right? But it does cause a deeper irritation. It can cause a little bit of a swelling and redness in the area, because these blood vessels in the dermal papillae start to swell up and maybe leak some fluids. But the cells in the stratum basale are really nice and alive. So that means then what can happen to that person's skin? It can heal, right? It can regenerate, no big problem. It might be a little uncomfortable, but they'll heal just fine. Second degree burn, right? Not only does the stratum corneum get damaged, but the stratum granulosum and maybe the spinosum over here, and there's some damage to the blood vessels to where they start to leak a lot of fluid, okay, into the dermis. So now you have a blister forming right here. That's what we call a second degree burn. But typically, those are not typically bad enough to damage the stratum basale. Okay, so what kind of concern do we have there? A little bit, but not a major thing, right? Because the stratum basale cells will regrow and replace all those cells that got damaged in these superficial layers. So that's not too bad, right? As long as you don't pop that blister, because if you pop that blister, then what? Bacteria can get underneath the epidermis, and you can lose fluids through those blisters, and dehydration can take place. So as long as you don't pop those blisters, you're in really good shape. Now, what about if somebody gets a third-degree burn? Let's talk about two different conditions of a third-degree burn. Somebody burns their skin all the way through the epidermis, down into the dermis, maybe to this layer right here, right like this. Is that a lucky person or an unlucky person? It might sound unlucky, but I want to change your opinion by analyzing these layers right here. I would still say that's a lucky person for the following reason. They're going to be miserable for sure, but look at the stratum basale right here. See the stratum basale? Are you tracing that with me? It's going and making up this sebaceous gland, but where does it go? It goes all the way down to the bottom of this hair follicle, right? So here are living stratum basale cells, and we said that this person with this typical third degree burn down to this layer right here has not damaged these stratum basale cells in a hair follicle. So as long as you protect this person from dehydration and infection, guess what these cells can do on the hair follicle? They can regenerate and a person's skin can grow back. So that person, okay, is pretty fortunate, because the stratum basale hasn't been destroyed completely over the surface of their skin. Now, what happens if somebody experiences a third degree burn that goes all the way down into the hypodermis, destroys the stratum basale cells even on these deep hair follicles right here? Okay, now that's an unlucky person for sure, because their skin will never grow back in that area. And then they need a graft. They need a graft from a donor animal until they get healthy again, and then they need an autograft from some other part of their body to replace the skin that will never grow back. Okay, so that just sort of is an illustration of how important it is to know the layers. Like the living layer of the epidermis is the stratum basale, and now you can trace it around through these different structures, accessory structures, and get a good idea of how we have to treat patients with different kinds of burns. Okay, some accessory structures. I talked maybe a little bit about accessory structures. All right, here's that muscle, the erector pili, that produces goosebumps. Here is an oil-producing gland, produces an oil called sebum. It's a sebaceous gland that lubricates this hair follicle as it's coming out from the integument. And another gland is this eccrine sweat gland. The third kind of gland that is not on this illustration but is in your lecture notes over here and your lab manual, that's the apocrine sweat gland in the inguinal and axillary regions of your body. Okay, then there are sensory receptors as well. Here are some free nerve endings. I don't see any specialized structures. Free nerve endings surround a hair follicle so that when this hair follicle moves back and forth, that stimulates these nerve endings so you can tell when something's brushing up against you or the wind is blowing on you. All right, here is one that kind of looks like an onion. This is a Pacinian corpuscle. Pacinian corpuscle is located very deep in the skin, or maybe even in the hypodermis layer. So this is for deep pressure. pressure that can even be damaging to your body. So it's sort of acting like a pain receptor in a sense. When it becomes activated, you'll withdraw that part of your body from that stimulus. So deep pressure and vibration by a Pacinian corpuscle. There are other things that sort of look like a Pacinian corpuscle that are tucked up away inside of a dermal papillae. Those are called Meissner's corpuscles. We have some nice models in lab that show a Meissner's corpuscle. Saw the Merkel's disc for light pressure and vibration again on the illustration of the epidermis. And then we see other free nerve endings. Here are some nerve endings that innervate the smooth muscle, causing it to contract. There are other free nerve endings that I see up over here. And free nerve endings are important for temperature sensation. So there are some that respond to cold temperatures. There are some that respond to hot temperatures. And sometimes the ones that respond to hot temperatures also, it's the cold ones. The ones that respond to cold sometimes also respond to very, very hot temperature. So sometimes when you put your part of your body in something really hot, it feels cold as a result of that. That's a paradoxical kind of sensation that you have. All right, so free nerve endings are important for temperature, but they're also important because when they get damaged, they send pain signals to your brain. So you know that certain part of your integument is being damaged, so you can move your body away from that painful stimulus. So pain receptors and temperature receptors are just free nerve endings. All right, pressure, touch, and vibration are due to these encapsulated nerve endings like a Pacinian corpuscle, a Merkel's disc, and a Meissner's corpuscle. Okay. Glands. Two basic kinds are sweat and sebaceous glands. Sebaceous gland is always going to be associated with a hair follicle. A sweat gland is going to be a bunch of coiled tubes someplace. Right, and you got two different kinds of sweat glands. You got an eccrine sweat gland versus an apocrine sweat gland. Eccrine is for secreting sweat, which is water and salts, and that increases the electrical conductivity of your skin. Right, those salts in solution, we call that galvanic conductance. So whenever you're sweating a lot, your skin can conduct electricity a lot better. That's used as a basis for a lie detector test. Right, because in most people, when you tell a lie, okay, these glands become activated and then the electrical properties of your skin changes. But if you're the kind of person that can lie and it doesn't affect you one way or the other, then these sweat glands don't become activated, so they can't tell with a lie detector test if you're telling the truth or not, if you're one of those kinds of people. So lie detector tests are not really introduced as evidence in a trial because sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. And you would never want to convict somebody based on some kind of data that doesn't have any meaning, that's meaningless. Apocrine, we said, right, has an organic solution that bacteria can use to produce body odor. Another kind of gland is ceruminous gland. It's a modified sweat gland, and we find those in your ear canal, in particular the external auditory canal, and it secretes a kind of sweat that has lipids in it, but longer chain lipids, and it comes out more like a wax, more of a waxy material, but nonetheless, it prevents your eardrum from desiccating or dehydrating, so it protects your inner ear, plus it's, I guess, kind of sticky, too. It prevents things from crawling inside your ear, right? But mostly it's for lubricating your tympanic membrane. And mammary glands, that's a modified sweat gland. Right, it's modified to produce milk. And so there are some hormones that are responsible for the maturation of mammary glands, and that's called prolactin. Right, prolactin is secreted from the pituitary gland, and then the glandular tissue of the breast develops during pregnancy. And then there's another hormone that causes a different response after a mammary gland is competent to produce milk. It has to eject milk. And that hormone is called oxytocin. So there are a couple hormones involved with making the mammary glands grow and proliferate, and another hormone called oxytocin that actually produces the secretion or the ejection of milk from the glandular tissue, for instance, when an infant starts to nurse on a nipple. Nails. Let's look at some nails. Let me show you some pictures of nails. Nails are accessory structures. Okay, so here is the body of the nail. These are just flat plates of keratinocytes layered on top of each other that grow out from the growing part of the nail that we call the nail matrix. So the nail matrix is underneath the skin in this area right here. This is where a nail grows from, and then it starts to grow out from underneath this proximal nail fold right here. And this part that's underneath the proximal nail fold, but it's not growing anymore, this is what we call the root. So a nail doesn't really grow from the root, it grows from the nail matrix. This is like the stratum basale of a nail as it's growing. All right, so you can damage the nail root, you can damage the body of a nail, but will a nail still grow? Yeah, as long as you don't damage the matrix of the nail, right? So if you damage the matrix, then the nail won't grow back as a result of that. So you can see the cuticle, which is this flap of skin, which is distal to the proximal nail fold. You can see the cuticle right here. And then here's the free edge of the nail, the tip of the nail. And what's the purpose of nails? To protect the fingertips from abrasion, because it's a hard part of your epithelium, but also self-defense. Okay, and then for grasping things as well. So it has a number of different functions. So I think this is an exam figure. Okay, so make sure you know this is the matrix, here's the root, the fold, the body, okay, the nail bed, and then here is some adipose tissue, and right here is the bone. And I'm going to tell you what the name of this bone is. It's called a phalanx. So this is a phalanx. And this part of your body, okay, we usually call that a finger, but it has a nice anatomical name. A finger or a toe is called a digit. These are all digits. And the bones that make up digits or fingers are called phalanges. One phalanges is called a phalanx. So how many phalanges do you have in your index finger right here? Okay, I see one, I see two, I see three. There are three phalanges, right? In this one digit right here. So we use that terminology, digit and phalanx, and I just see one. There's a distal one at the top, there's a proximal one at the beginning of, at the base of your finger, and the one in the middle is called the middle. So that's nice. Sometimes anatomy is nice and simple. So this is the distal phalanx right here. Okay. So let's see if there's anything else about the skin that I need to talk about. No, that's pretty much about it. Okay, so know something about pigments, the different kinds of cells that are in the skin. For sure know all the layers of the skin. Okay, and which way things grow, from the basale up to the stratum corneum. Okay, that's good. That's pretty good for skin. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that introductory chapter on bones. I think that's a good idea because why? Because that's on that first test. I don't want to just push everything up to the very end, just make that next lecture just pressure packed for you to know, because later that week you have your first practicum. So I think it's good to hear a little bit about this before the weekend. Okay? So let me find some materials for that introductory chapter on bones. That's chapter 6. So here's 6. So I'll give you a little bit of an introduction for bones. And then the word slides. Bones and skeletal tissue. Okay, I'll just give you a little bit. Maybe we'll practice a flash quiz too. Okay, so we're talking about the skeletal system, skeletal tissues, bones and skeletal tissues. So I want you to know the components that make up the skeletal system. And the components are bone, that would be a good guess, but also cartilage and ligaments. All right, so what kind of tissue is bone? connective tissue. And, as a matter of fact, we say bone connective tissue. What about cartilage? That's connective tissue. You got a couple different kinds. You got hyaline cartilage, you got fibrocartilage, you got elastic cartilage, right? And then this third component right here, ligament, what kind of tissue is that? That's connective tissue again, and that's dense, regular connective tissue. Ligament is dense, regular connective tissue. It's loaded with collagen, oriented in all the same direction. So here we have an illustration of some of the components of the skeletal system. Of course, we have bones. And then in blue, we have cartilage, and maybe even in other colors, we have fibrocartilage, like the pubic symphysis right here, intervertebral discs, fibrocartilage, and then elastic cartilage. A good example, for instance, would be in the ear. All right, what I don't see are ligaments on this diagram, but don't forget, ligaments are part of the skeletal system. All right, so here I see a bunch of bones. All right, so the functions of the skeletal system, number one, one of the most important is support. Bones are very rigid. They're made out of tubes, microscopic tubes inside of tubes we talked about in lab. And so it's almost impossible to compress a bone from a superior to an inferior aspect along the long axis of a bone. This one right here is the femur. Right? It might be easy to break the femur if you push on it from side to side, but not if you push on it from top to bottom. So this femur can support a lot of weight. Can bear great weight. Bone is rigid and strong. Cartilage, on the other hand, is firm but flexible, so it's a little bit bendy. And since it's firm but not as strong as bone, it's a lot lighter. It takes a lot less energy to haul around cartilage all day long compared to if all the cartilage in your body was bone. It would take a lot more energy to do that. All right, so cartilage can be used to make up your nose, your ear, rib cage. And your rib cage, all these things are bendable. Your rib cage is changing shape every time you inhale and exhale, so it allows for motion very nicely. Cartilage is also used during development as a precursor or a model for bone formation. So before you actually have a bone in your thigh right here, the femur, it's actually built as a model out of cartilage first, and then that cartilage turns into bone, and then you have a nice bony femur right here. All right, so that's a pretty important function. All right, another function is protection. It forms armor plating. All right, like the skull is armor plating for what organ? Yeah, your brain. All right, and the vertebral column is armor plating for the spinal cord. So brain and spinal cord, nervous tissue that's very delicate and soft. And then the rib cage is sort of like armor plating. It's not quite so continuous as the cranium and the vertebral column, but it's armor plating that protects your heart and your lungs. Nonetheless, these are all vital organs, right? So it protects them from trauma and puncture and things of that nature. All right, so protection is important. But on these bones right here, there are certain kinds of muscles that attach to them. And can anybody remember the kinds of muscles that you have? You got smooth muscle, skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle. Okay, and skeletal muscle is named because it attaches to your skeleton, and when muscle only is designed to contract, and when skeletal muscle contracts, it moves your skeleton around, right? So that's important for mobility. So skeletal muscle moves your skeleton around, and one of the characteristics of skeletal muscle is that it's under voluntary control. So the position of your skeleton is really the only thing that you can control of all the different organs inside your body. Everything else is controlled automatically by the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so skeletal muscle is attached to the skeleton, and that moves your bones around because there's a connection between a muscle and a bone, and that's what we call a tendon. A bone-to-bone connection is a ligament, but a bone-to-muscle connection is a tendon. It's exactly the same kind of tissue. It's dense, regular CT. Where joints come together, that forms a joint. Sometimes we call that an articulation. And on joints, the joints are covered, the ends of bones are covered with hyaline cartilage, which is kind of slippery, and it allows these bones to slip and slide over each other without grinding each other down. Okay, some people get a little unlucky and that cartilage becomes damaged, maybe by natural processes or by autoimmune disease. And when that cartilage becomes damaged, the bones, these opposite bones right here, can touch each other, and then they do start to grind each other away and produce an inflammation, a painful inflammation. What do we call that? That's called arthritis, right? And then the joints can become really deformed and inflamed, and that's arthritis. Ligaments are bone-to-bone connections. Most of the times it's used to prevent or limit motion between bones. So we'll look at some ligaments in this class. Another function of bone is for storage. It stores calcium ions. Anytime you see a chemical that has an electrical charge like this plus right there or this minus right here, those are electrolytes in your body. They produce some electrical properties inside your body. Calcium is stored in bones, and it's used for a lot of different processes. One of the functions is that it makes bones strong, but that's probably not the most important function for calcium in your body. So when you start to lose calcium, your body goes to bones and takes it out of bones and gives it to your brain and your heart and muscles and nerves so that they can function properly. All right, so that's why when we get older and we have trouble absorbing calcium in our diet or lack calcium in our diet, it produces a condition called, everybody's going to experience this condition, it's called osteoporosis, right? When our bones become brittle and weak because they're losing calcium. It affects women to a greater degree than men, okay, because men typically have bigger, stronger bones to begin with, so they can afford to lose more calcium before they get brittle, all right? But if you're a woman with stronger, thicker bones, then you're kind of lucky, you're kind of protected from osteoporosis. But nonetheless, osteoporosis is a really strange disease process because it will affect everybody if you're lucky enough to live old enough, okay? Especially women. And that's so strange because if there's a flu going around or a cold, will everybody in here get that flu? No, some of us will be more resistant than others, right? So that's why osteoporosis is kind of a funny disease. Everybody, if you live long enough, will have to deal with it. So, how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? It has to do with that calcium in bones, so proper diet is important. You've got to make sure you have proper calcium in your diet. But we also talked about a vitamin that's necessary for you to absorb that calcium that's in your diet to put it in your body, and that was vitamin D. So diet's important because you get calcium, but that's where you get vitamin D from as well as some sunlight. So diet is important for vitamin D and calcium. All right, and then that calcium will end up in this bone if you do what? And this is why people hate anatomy and physiology classes. Because that calcium won't end up in this bone unless you exercise. So diet and exercise is the way to protect yourself from osteoporosis. All right, so the bones that you have in your body are not the ones that you had 5 years ago. Every 5 years, your skeleton becomes completely rebuilt and remodeled. So if you're exercising, lifting weights, not only does your muscle get bigger and stronger, but what happens to your bone? It gets bigger and stronger as well, right? And that's what protects you from osteoporosis. So exercise is so important. So remember, bone is a living tissue. It's not a dead tissue like that cement column right there that's holding up the roof on this building. It's a living tissue that responds to your daily activities. So if there's no activity in your life, what happens to these bones? They atrophy. They get smaller and thinner. And then the person is more susceptible to osteoporosis as a result of that. Okay, so calcium is stored in bones, but there's also inorganic phosphate, which is PO4. That's important for a number of metabolic processes in your body, but it also helps make bones strong. And then in bones, like this femur right here, there is a big cavity, and we call it the medullary cavity because it's deep. The medullary part of an organ is the deep part. The cortex is the superficial part of an organ. And cavities just are not wasted spaces, they're filled with stuff, right? In a young individual, it's filled with red bone marrow. Red bone marrow is responsible for making blood cells. Like example would be a red blood cell, okay? And then in the adult, that red bone marrow slowly is converted over time into yellow bone marrow, and yellow bone marrow is just a storage form of fat, right? So fat is stored inside bones in those medullary cavities. All right, and where else do you store fat? Where can you store half your body fat? In your skin, actually right below the skin in that subcutaneous layer that we call the hypodermis. Okay, the last function of blood in red bone marrow, okay, in red bone marrow, that produces red blood cells. That's a very important process. We call it hemopoiesis. Because what can you tell me about a red blood cell? They're anucleate. They don't have a nucleus, which means they can't repair themselves, so they have a very short lifespan. They only live for about 120 days, and then they disappear. They're recycled by the liver and the spleen. And so your body has to replace those red blood cells. How many red blood cells do you lose every second? Millions, between 1 and 2 million red blood cells. So that means that this yellow bone marrow producing red blood cells have to replace 1 to 2 million red blood cells in your body every second. Otherwise, you become what? You become anemic as a result of that. So bone is a hematopoietic tissue. It produces red blood cells and platelets. Oh, so a hematopoietic tissue is what kind of tissue? It's a tissue that can make red blood cells for you so that you don't become anemic. All right, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet today. And we're going to continue on with cartilage next time and then talk about bone growth a little bit. And then make sure you bring all your questions in for the exam on Wednesday, 1 week from today.